This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A man's home is his castle, as the saying goes, but what about the house next door? Last month in Pasadena, Texas, Joe Horn saw two men breaking into his neighbor's home, and he called 911. The dispatcher tried to calm him down.
They just stole something. I'm going out the window. I'm sorry. I ain't going to let them get away with this. They stole something. They got a bag of something.
The house.
I'm going to.
Mr. Horn, do not I'm go sorry. Outside the house.
This ain't right, buddy.
You're going to get yourself shot if you go outside that house with a gun.
You want to make a
what
bet?
You think. Okay, stay in the house.
They're getting just, away.
That's all right. Property's not worth killing someone over. Which way are they going?
I can't. I'm going outside. I'll find out.
No, I don't want you going outside, Mr. Horn.
Well, here it goes, buddy. You hear the shotgun clicking, and I'm going.
Don't go outside. I'm going to get on your radio.
Move. You're dead.
Both the burglars died. Some hail Joe Horn as a hero, others denounce him as a trigger-happy vigilante. And there are other cases in California, New York, and Florida which raise questions about the law and self-defense. Many states employ these so-called make-my-day laws, also known as the Castle Doctrine. They allow citizens to respond with force to protect themselves in their homes. In some, the principle extends to your office and your car. Other states have laws that require citizens to retreat unless there's a direct threat to their lives. Later in the program, we'll talk with Muslim comedian Sarfraz Manzoor about his comedic heroes like Woody Allen. But first, the limits of self-defense. If you have personal experience with this issue as a victim or as a police officer, we want to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also tell us your stories on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Cindy Horswell, a reporter for the Houston Chronicle, who's been covering the Joe Horn story. She covers us, but joins us by phone from her home in Kingswood, Texas. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Nice to be here.
And what exactly happened? We heard the 911 tape. Does that tell the whole story?
It's not the full story. I mean, that was what was he was speaking to the dispatcher, and that's what was said at the time. But, of course, you know, other facts have come out about the circumstances and what was actually happening at the site.
And at the time when Mr. Horn went outside with his shotgun, apparently the two men were leaving the neighbor's house carrying a bag, which was later found to contain valuables and cash.
Right. Yes, they had a bag. He saw them go in as he was talking to the 911 operator, trying to report it, trying to get someone to come out there. As you noticed, they were asking him questions. At one point, he decided to go out in his yard, and what happened was they had left the house that was burglarized and come down between the houses and were in his front yard when he came outside. So they were 7 feet apart when he said, "Move, and you're dead." One fled away from him. One came towards him but was really angling towards the curb. He shot the one coming towards him first, the one that was going away from him second. Within, as you could hear, in a matter of seconds, both ended up being shot in the back, because, which is not unusual, the police said, because a moving target, you know, by the time you react, take aim and shoot, they're not exactly in the same place in the same direction. But he was obviously a pretty good shot to do that in fairly fast succession. But he did have a shotgun.
On another part of the tape we didn't hear, he identified the people breaking into the neighbor's house as black, and it turns out that they were undocumented aliens from Colombia.
Yes, they were here illegally, and in fact, one of them had been deported before, had been to jail for selling cocaine here, and then been sent out of the country, you know, sent back to his country, somehow ended up back here again, they have black features, but they have Hispanic surnames. He was asked to describe them, and his lawyer says that the reason he went outside was they kept asking questions he couldn't answer. He couldn't see what had happened to them after they went in the house, and that his goal was to see what vehicle they were driving or get a license plate number. But he was surprised to find them in his own yard. And if you listen to the second 911 tape, that calls back after he's fired the shots, he says, "They're in my front yard, they're in my front yard. I didn't know what the expletive they were going to do," and, you know, kind of saying that he was, you know...
He felt threatened.
Felt threatened.
And it turned out there was a car parked in front of his house. It was a police car with an undercover cop in it.
Yes, it was a police car, but it was an unmarked police car, and the guy was in plain clothes. He had pulled up before Horn came outside, and was just seeing the two with the bag come between the houses, and he was really assessing the situation, trying to figure out what's. It happened within seconds. It wasn't real fast, and then Horn came out, and the shots were fired. But he saw the whole thing.
In fact, he ducked down in fear of his life because he thought Mr. Horn might think he was the getaway driver.
You know, you really don't know, right? The police, you know, in an unmarked car. And in fact, see, they didn't have their car there. They never did find the car of the men that went in that house, who were from Houston and were in Pasadena, which is kind of a suburb of Houston. So they do believe there was a third person involved. Maybe that's where they were headed when they were going across his yard. It's just an unknown. So there was no other car there. It could have been logical that he would be assumed to be the person they were going toward as they came in the yard. It's one of those situations where you don't have a whole lot of time to assess and evaluate before everything's happening.
And what has since happened to Mr. Horn?
Now, he has been investigated, and he is waiting to see the outcome of the investigation. The case has been looked at since it happened in November, and they just presented it Friday, I believe it was, last Friday, to the grand jury, to the district attorney's office, which will review the report and then present it to the grand jury to see if there should be charges. And it's very complex because they were in his yard, but, you know, they were burglarizing someone else's house. It wasn't his house. So in Texas, that's not the Castle Doctrine.
And the Castle Doctrine does apply in Texas. It's also, there are obviously racial aspects to this, which have been taken up by some, but the neighbors whose house Mr. Horn was defending, I guess, they're Vietnamese.
Right, they are. They're Vietnamese. And, you know, they were very glad to get, they haven't spoken publicly, but they have thanked his lawyers. Horn's lawyer says that they have thanked him personally for helping them. And he had seen them break into the house with a crowbar, but then police didn't find the crowbar. But when the family that lived there, the Vietnamese family, returned home, they didn't want to come home for a while because it was a very tense situation out there for a few days, a lot of protesting and so forth. So when they did come home, they did find the crowbar, but they left it inside the house. And so they called Mr. Horn to tell him that the crowbar is here, and he told him to call the police. The police came out and got it. So they were relieved to get their money because they weren't apparently using banks, and they had a lot of cash on hand.
And as I understand it, there have been protests for and against Mr. Horn's actions.
Yes. Yes. The new Black Panther Party, Quan L. X, is the head of that here, and he's led at least two protests in front of Mr. Horn's house. He believes that, you know, that he was taking everything into his own hands, becoming judge, jury, and executioner, and that, you know, he should have been arrested at the time that this happened, he didn't have a right to, you know, determine whether these people were guilty or innocent. And then the second time he led another protest there, he was met by a lot of people that think he's a hero, and some had a lot of motorcycles. It was a sort of a rough crowd, and there was a lot of confrontation. It was kind of got rowdy, and no one was arrested, but there were kind of police and riot gear there. And so now Pasadena has passed a law that you cannot protest in front of someone's house.
New laws.
A new law,
yeah.
Yes.
Cindy Horswell, thanks very much. I will keep up with this case.
Okay.
Cindy Horswell, a reporter for the Houston Chronicle, covering the Joe Horn story for the Houston Chronicle. Joining us here in Studio 3A in Washington is Jonathan Turley. Cindy Horswell was describing that case of deadly force in Pasadena. Jonathan Turley is professor of public interest law at George Washington University, and nice to have you back on the program today.
Thank you.
And I know you've looked into some of the examples of this case, but the Castle Law that you talked about in Texas, there are variants of this in many states.
There are variants of it, and I think a majority of states have some form of a Castle Law or Make My Day law. And in fact, you can find them under the heading Make My Day as a gesture to the Sudden Impact movie by Clint Eastwood. But there's also Make My Day Better laws. believe it or not, and those are laws that would extend this to businesses and to cars. They all are designed to do the same thing. They're designed to negate the common law rule. The interesting thing is that the dispatcher on the tape actually stated the common law rule very, very well when he said, it's not worth shooting someone for property. That's what the common law long believed, that a human life, even a burglar, is worth more than any property that he can take. And so under the common law, you could not use force calculated to cause serious bodily injury or death unless you were acting in self-defense. So these laws get rid of that by essentially saying anytime someone enters your domicile or home, you are allowed, you're privileged to use lethal force. It also gets away from the requirement of retreat, that in many states you had a duty to retreat if you could. The common law actually didn't have that duty. In America, you're allowed to stand your ground. So if one of my students comes charging at me with a double-headed axe when I could just close the door, I'm not required to do so under the common law. I'm allowed to use lethal force.
If you happen to have a double-edged axe behind your back. But there's another case. If Mr. Horn was advised, just stay, the police are coming. And as it turned out, the police got there. You don't know what would have happened, but the police officer was there in time to see the men, two men, leaving the house with a bag full of swag.
Well, that's exactly right. Well, one of the great criticisms of these laws is that they pretty much solved a problem that didn't exist. That juries really didn't convict people that shot burglars. You know, it's hard to find a jury that says, "Gosh, you know, you were really harsh with that guy that kicked the door of your room in." So there wasn't a great need to pass the law, but it's very popular politically. It resonates with people. But the ironic thing is that the laws are almost always used in mistake cases, that they involve people who shoot their spouses and shoot their neighbors. Actually, this is a seasonal thing. We see most of these cases during the holidays. When people get drunk, they go to a development with like-looking houses and get shot by their neighbor.
For walking in the wrong door.
Exactly.
Jonathan Turley, stay with us. We're talking about self-defense, the decision to use deadly force. Coming up, we'll talk more about it and take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. We'd like to hear from those of you who've been personally involved in one of these cases. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about self-defense and the use of deadly force this hour. In cases from Florida to California, homeowners are picking up weapons in defense of their homes and property, sometimes with deadly results. If you've ever been on any side of this issue as a victim or as a law enforcement officer, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guest is Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University. And let's get a caller on the line. And we'll begin with Nicole. Nicole with us from Baltimore in Maryland.
Hi.
Hi there.
This past June, my husband walked in on a robber that was leaving our house with bags full of our stuff. And he chased him down and started to get in a fist fight with him and was beating him about the head until the guy pulled the knife. And then he let him get away. And then he followed him and the cops came and they did not pursue the robber. And so I guess my question is, you know, is that legal? I've had people tell me that he could go to jail for beating the guy up.
Yeah, and even if there is a castle law in Maryland, and I live in Maryland and don't know that, but even if there is one, does it extend to the street and down the street, Jonathan Turley?
Well, there's a great controversy of how far the curtilage of a house extends. There have been cases where people have argued that they shot people down in one case, a driveway that was 200 feet long, and the court still considered it part of the curtilage of the house. Obviously, down the street won't make it. But the interesting thing about the common law is that it has almost an internal trick. You are allowed to protect property under what's called the Mahler Manus Doctrine. That is, you're allowed to, it's Latin for laying gentle hands upon someone. And you can be not so gentle. You can actually try to get your property back. But the interesting thing about that doctrine is that it easily translates or transforms into self-defense. The minute somebody resists and threatens you, particularly with a knife, you are allowed to use lethal force. I would say to Nicole, I think that he's actually fine in terms of what he did. I'm not too sure I think it was a good idea, but legally, he probably is not really in serious legal jeopardy.
But if it just and Nicole, thanks for the call, and we hope your husband feels well about this.
Thank you.
But hypothetically, if that burglar hadn't had a knife and Nicole's husband wails on him, could he then sue the man for beating him up?
Probably not. First of all, it's hard pressed to find a jury that would say, "How dare you treat that burglar that way?" But more importantly, the minute he tried to grab his property back, which he's allowed to do even under the common law, and there was resistance, he can claim self-defense. So I think that he's fine. The problem is that when you have the use of weapons and you have these homicides, they're often defined as justifiable homicides. The interesting thing about that, by the way, is that nearly half of the justifiable homicides in this country occur in just four states, California, Michigan, Oklahoma, and Louisiana.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Peter. Peter with us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hello.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I just wanted to share an experience. I'm very interested in this discussion. I had some personal experience a couple of years ago. I woke up 3 in the morning, heard someone breaking in my front door, and came downstairs with a shotgun and found a young man, teenager, on the threshold of my son's bedroom. And that was a pretty intense thing. I cornered him with the shotgun and forced him to show me that he was not armed, and my son was, of course, screaming and hysterical and frightened. And once I had ascertained that this young man was unarmed, I gave him the option of leaving, which he did very quickly. And I guess the point that I wanted to make was that even in that situation, even with an intruder in my house and someone who probably was a burglar, it was not worth taking somebody's life simply for property. I was willing to let him go as long as he would not harm me or harm my family.
You didn't think, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you didn't think to say, well, then just stay there and tell your son to call 911 and get the police?
Well, I called the police as soon as he was out the door. I really couldn't operate a Remington 870 and a cell phone simultaneously.
I can understand that.
So I think that's an important part of the discussion, is that I think a lot of people feel that way, that there's legitimate self-defense, but killing somebody over property is something that I have a really hard time understanding.
It's also, I wanted to ask you about the surge of emotion you must be feeling. The adrenaline racing through your bloodstream must have been extraordinary.
It was intense. Yes, it was. That's where being an ex-Marine was some assistance.
Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And in that case, clearly, Peter seemed to have done the right thing.
Well, he not only did the right thing, he did an extraordinary thing. As a father of four, I don't know if I could have shown the same restraint. But the point is, I think, from the story, is that you can show that restraint, and it's a good idea, because many times these cases involve mistakes. You have the famous case in Louisiana involving Rodney Pierce, whose wife was scared by a Japanese student who was approaching, whose English was not very good. And the Japanese student continued to approach the house. He was looking for a Halloween party. And the husband shot him with a .44 Magnum and said there was something in his hand. It turned out to be a camera. And it horrified the world that you could do this. But he was cleared of all charges. It was considered to be reasonable. So you can have a reasonable mistake. We could debate how reasonable that mistake was. So what Peter did was an extraordinary act as a human being to show that restraint.
There's a case, I think a jury is deliberating right now on Long Island in New York, where a man, a black man, who moved to a virtually all-white neighborhood, his son got involved in some sort of an altercation with some other kids at a bar. Came back home, the white kids came up to their lawn and wanted to confront the father, and his son both went out onto the lawn with firearms, the son with a shotgun, his father with a handgun. The gun discharged, the father says accidentally, the prosecution says not, and he's being charged with homicide.
Yeah, in fact, there is a close analogy between Mr. White and Mr. Horn. They both intentionally went out, knowingly went out, to encounter the danger and to effectively escalate. In the case of Mr. Horn, you had a two-bit burglary going on. In the case of Mr. White, you had some kids who seemed to be engaged in racial epithets and inappropriate conduct. But they both escalated the scenes. And it was, in my view, with Mr. White, a very stupid act to go out with guns.
The man in New York, yeah.
That's right, to stay within your home. But the interesting thing is that most of these cases do, in fact, involve minorities being shot. But they often involve a very high number of the shooters being minorities themselves. So there is not evidence of a great racial element here. And in fact, I don't think that the Horn case really screams out as a racial case. But often they do trigger that because there is these powerful cultural emotions. One case on December 7th involving Shannon Edmonds in California, where he shot two individuals dead and a third ran from his home. They were minorities, and it became a great issue as to whether he should be charged. But in that case, once again, his son was beaten so severely by these individuals, they were being held hostage in their homes, that he suffered brain damage. And what's turned out is that the surviving burglar is going to be charged with a felony murder for effectively the death of his cohorts.
Similar case in Florida, where a black man driving his car, two white men came up to him, shouted racial epithets, get out of the car, N-word. He pulled his gun, which he had a license for, and shot them both, one dead, died later of his wounds. The other one is now being charged with felony murder for his taking part in a felony which resulted in a death.
Yes, and also possible hate crimes in addition. That one is very compelling because of a tape as well. Because unlike Mr. Horn, who I think has real problems with the tape, because it sounds like he was just itching to go out there to confront these guys. In that other case, you had the individual who was terribly upset that he had shot these individuals and immediately gave the details as to why.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Juan. Juan with us from Minneapolis.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're on the air.
Most of my stuff's going to sound pretty rhetorical. 20 years ago, I got mugged by six individuals with clubs. They tried to kill me. I was very young, very strong, very athletic. I managed to fight my way clear. Don't know how I did it. Today, I'm 64. If somebody laid hands on me in that manner again, I'd be very likely to have a heart attack. I absolutely consider it to be my obligation to go home to my wife and my 11-year-old son at the end of each day. And woe betide the person who threatens my life ever again.
Well, Juan's case, Jonathan Turley, sounds like a clear case of self-defense.
That's right. The law supports you exactly in that purpose. You are allowed to go home. And we also look in the law at the differential in age, weight, size, to determine whether someone was facing a threat. You're allowed to use a level of force that's commensurate with the threat. Now, it doesn't mean if someone brings out a broken bottle, you got to go find yourself a broken bottle. It means that if someone is threatening you with serious bodily injury because of your weight, their size, or what they're holding in their hands, you're allowed, effectively, to kill them.
Juan, this is clearly something that you've never forgotten.
Certainly not, sir. Certainly not. I got a dead spot in my brain. I think all persons should have the absolute right to defend themselves.
Thank you very much for the call, and I'm sorry the incident happened. Here's an email from Jeff in Chicago. The particular phrasing of the law is critical. In Illinois, one may only use deadly force as a person is entering the home in a, quote, tumultuous, unquote, manner. Thus, a burglar who's entering in a stealthy way, who probably does not want any contact with the residents, should not be killed, while a home invader crashing through a door could be.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. These laws actually differ in very significant ways. Many of the laws actually require some showing of violent elements or threat before lethal force is used. Others say that you don't have to have that. Effectively, someone's in your home, you can assume it. And then you have what are called the shoot the carjacker laws. And these are laws in places like Louisiana that give you the same privilege. Someone tries to carjack, you are given the privilege to use lethal force. Well, obviously, that's really a recipe for disaster if people misunderstand what's happening.
Here's another email. This is from Fred in Durham, North Carolina. As an example of where the duty to retreat law in North Carolina at the time was practical, I pulled up at a gas station late at night. Next door, about 100 feet away, two people were trying to break into another store. One came running toward me with a crowbar, a deadly weapon. Had I stood my ground, my life would have been threatened. However, I avoided danger by getting in my car and driving away. There never was a question that retreat was available and was safe. No one could have run 100 feet in the time it took me to get back into the car and leave. Under some proposals, I would have been right to get my gun and shoot the robbers, taking the law into my own hands and making robbery a capital crime.
Well, that's exactly right. And what's also fascinating about the no duty now to retreat is that it can quickly escalate these circumstances where retreat is something that can be easily done. And in his case, he did the right thing, and he was able to de-escalate the situation. It goes to that old military term that if you only have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Well, if you're focused on the handgun in your pocket, that seems to be the solution. And you sometimes forget the better solution might be to close your door and call police.
We're talking with Jonathan Turley of the George Washington University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Patrick is with us. Patrick on the line from Lansing, Michigan.
How you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I had a personal situation. It actually occurred in Colorado, where I was attacked by two individuals. And during the attack, I ended up getting the upper hand on the two and became the aggressor in the situation. And then the police came, and I was arrested for becoming the aggressor, and I lost. The prosecutor said that I could not do a self-defense because I had an opportunity to leave, and instead of leaving, I beat him up, and so I ended up going to jail for it.
Was this outside or in your house or where?
This was actually outside near a local convenience store.
And
what it was is they were initially going to, I believe, rob me, but I don't know. It didn't get to that point where they came up. One hit me from behind, and then the other one was in front. So during the fighting, I got the upper hand and ended up, both of them ended up going to the hospital. Attempted to get the self-defense law, and the prosecutor would not allow it to go through, and the prosecutor actually charged me.
And were you convicted?
I was convicted, and I went to prison for 3 years for it.
That seems, obviously, Jonathan Turley, we don't know all the details of the case, but that seems unusual.
It is very unusual. The principle is that when you're using self-defense, there is a limitation that once you are no longer threatened, you lose the privilege to engage in a violent response. But I have to say that it's exceptionally rare for a prosecutor to slice this salami so thin as to say, I can see the point at which you got the upper hand and you lost that privilege. It's very, very rare. It usually happens when there's an escalation in the level of force, when somebody starts to have a fistfight effectively or a shoving match and someone pulls out a gun and shoots them. That's when prosecutors often say, you crossed the line.
Thanks very much, Patrick, and I'm sorry for the time in jail.
Well, learning experience, so thank you.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye. You too.
Right.
Jonathan Turley, which way is the law going? Are more and more states adopting these so-called Make My Day or the Castle Doctrine laws?
Well, we've seen a slowdown. There was a great move in this direction. It was very popular for politicians. They went from Make My Day to Make My Day Better to Shooting the Carjacker, and they all had almost festive names. And they certainly had a popular response with citizens. But we're now seeing an increase in these types of mistakes. You know, as I mentioned before, there weren't any significant cases where homeowners were being said, we're going to send you to jail because we wish you had not, you know, shot the burglar. Juries just don't do that. So most of the cases you see are like the ones in Louisiana. They're mistake cases. Somebody shoots their wife. Someone shoots their neighbor. And it's incredibly common, particularly around this time, when you've got developments with houses that look the same and people that have been drinking and they drop their keys and they go through that side window and they end up staring right down the barrel of a gun. And it takes a lot of control to have someone like Peter who's going to say, I've got the drop on this guy, but I'm actually not going to, you know, pull the trigger.
You even think of the case of Sean Taylor, the football player who was burglars broke into his house, he confronted them and got shot and killed.
That's right. And on the other end of that spectrum, you have someone like Bernard Goetz in New York who had a gun.
The subway vigilante.
That's right. And there was little question that the teens in that case had a threatening posture that they surrounded. But there was this question of escalation, whether he could have walked away. And there was, in that case, a very strong racial undertone.
Jonathan Turley, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
My great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University, with us here today in Studio 3A. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, a Muslim walks into a comedy club and talks about his hero, Woody Allen. It's no joke. Sarfraz Manzoor joins us to talk about comedy and a Muslim audience. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.